CIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mahdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph's tomb, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts.
Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The United States midterm elections began with many reminding that the party of the sitting president almost always loses seats in Congress. With inflation at a record high, economic instability the worst in decades, and the unrest in Ukraine quickly becoming America's latest forever war, early polling had many expecting a Republican red wave.
I think if the Republicans do win, it might be a dramatic shift. I can't really say for the better or for the worse. We just have to, you know, pop some popcorn and see what happens, you know.
The campaign was marked by each side accusing the other of being extremists. Republicans portrayed Democrats as cultural and economic radicals, whereas Democrats insisted that Republicans were intent on destroying American democracy. The mutual fear-mongering has led to 9 out of 10 Americans saying that they now fear politically related violence.
I'm just glad it's over. That's it. I'd like to get back to normal again somehow, some way. I hope they take it well because we've been through this one time before and they know what to expect, so I don't think there's that much to get excited about. I just hope we just go back to being good citizens again.
At the end of Election Day, which party will rule Congress was still in doubt, as an easy Republican victory was not apparent. The United States continues to have prolonged difficulties with counting votes, a major cause of the widespread doubt regarding the integrity of their electoral system. It may take days or possibly weeks to decide the final outcome, meaning that the United States is having another incredibly unstable election, with tension and division seemingly certain to increase.
If the Republicans, well, I just hope that they do the job like everybody else, be it Democrats, Republican, you name it. If people would just be for the people, really in the real sense of the word, I think that the world in general will be a better place.
Candidates on both sides have threatened to refuse to recognize the results if they aren't the winner, meaning that America's election day could drag into election month once again. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods, and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aid if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses, and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
Iran has recently unveiled the newest version of its homegrown missile defense system, Bavar 373, which is said to have taken one step closer to the Russian-made S-400 anti-aircraft weapon system. During the test fire, a stationary target was detected at a range of more than 450 kilometers by the optimized radar of the missile system and was tracked at a range of about 405 kilometers and was hit at a range of more than 300 kilometers. The long-range missile has solid fuel and was evaluated during operation for the first time. The detection radar range of the Bavar 373 system has increased from 350 to 450 kilometers, and its engagement radar range has increased from 260 to 400 kilometers. The Bavar 373 long-range air defense system is capable of detecting up to 100 targets, tracking 60 of them, and engaging with 6 concurrently.
All air defense systems are divided into 3 main categories based on their missions and operations, including long-range, middle-range, and short-range systems. Bavar 373 is a long-range missile system. Only 4 or 5 countries in the world have the technology to manufacture such a strategically important missile system. These countries do not even allow other countries to master such a technology, and if they provide any country with such a missile system, they will operate and overhaul the systems themselves, and operational and communicational codes are not given to the using country.
A distinguishing feature of Bavar 373 is its vertical launching system with square launchers, mostly used for air defense on warships. The system's missile range has increased from 200 to 300 kilometers, and its engagement altitude has increased from 27 to 32 kilometers.
The great achievement, which has been made as a result of the production of Bavar 373, aside from its defensive goals, is that this project has institutionalized the path of developing anti-aircraft air defense system inside the country. It means that we're now highly capable of producing any form of anti-air defense system inside the country with the help of our own universities, startup companies, and Iranian youth and specialists. By using Bavar 373 missile system, we can counter different types of missiles, bombers, and ballistic missiles.
The Bavar air defense system employs three different types of missiles to hit targets at various altitudes. It's been able to hit targets just 5 minutes after fire at an altitude of 43,000 feet.
Iran maintains that its military might poses no threat to regional countries, stressing that the Islamic Republic's defense doctrine is entirely based on deterrence. Saman Kudrip, Tehran.
Supporters of former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan blocked the key avenues and roads leading towards country's capital Islamabad, causing massive traffic jams, halting logistics, and forcing schools and offices to close. Khan, who is demanding immediate elections, survived the assassination attempt last Thursday in the eastern Punjab province, leaving him wounded along with his several party workers. Police have arrested the suspected shooter and registered a case against him. However, Imran Khan and his supporters are not satisfied with it, demanding that Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, Interior Minister Rana Sanaullah, and a senior military official be investigated through a UN inquiry for their alleged involvement in the attack.
There's only one national leader whose name is Imran Khan. Everybody is behind him. We want free and fair investigation under United Nations investigation board.
The masses on the streets were irked due to the violent protest and road closures, asking authorities to end what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Petra Bas Lip is the mother of Alina Lip, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it? You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case, they just didn't even tell you, they just shut it down?
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
How did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So this, the state told you that? The state told you to go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lip for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see the, Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's move impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us maybe also. It's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of a suppressive state or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects by the Ukrainian SBU. For Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with 8 other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical, and for example, on the Ukraine issue, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch will stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Hamirzad, Kabul.
The limelight.
There is no end in sight regarding the cost of living crisis in Europe. This continent was doomed to decline after the 2008 global financial recession. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, Germany's gas storage facilities may rapidly become depleted if the weather turns cold. Klaus Müller, the head of Germany's Federal Network Agency, said in an interview with Der Spiegel, published recently. Müller told the outlet, "A few freezing cold days are enough for a dramatic increase in gas consumption. We know from historical data that when it gets really frosty, the storage tanks are quickly drained." The official added that Germany can get through the winter, but only if both citizens and industries join efforts to end lower gas consumption by at least 20%. Last month, the country's industries were able to lower consumption by 20%, and private households and businesses did even better with 42%, he said, noting, however, that this had to do with the warm weather and might change in the event of a cold snap. As of November 2nd, Germany's gas storage facilities were 99.3% full, which, according to Müller, is enough to keep the country going for up to 10 weeks as the only source of gas. Germany, along with other EU states, has been gradually reducing its reliance on Russian energy supplies. According to Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock, the share of Russian gas among the country's energy imports recently dropped to 6 to 8%, while in 2021 more than half of Germany's gas supply came from Russia. To make up for the loss, Berlin has focused on building liquefied natural gas terminals. The country will have two floating regasification for receiving seaborne LNG by the end of the year, and two more by May 2023, the authorities claimed. Their total annual capacity is estimated at 33 billion cubic meters of natural gas. Also, RT reported France's largest glass manufacturer, Duralex, has suspended operations for 5 months due to soaring electricity prices. The company's CEO, José Luis Lacana, told BFM TV channel recently, "Our gas and electricity bills have risen from 3 to 13 million euros a year. The price of energy usually represents 5% to 7% of our turnover. Today, it is around 46%. It is not tenable," he explained, adding that the company's operation had become non-viable as it is unable to make a profit after such a staggering outlays for energy, in addition to paying salaries and procuring raw materials. He added that during the five-month closure, Duralex employees would continue to receive 95% of their salaries, 70% of which will be covered by the state. The head of the company noted, however, that its warehouses are currently sufficiently stocked to survive the winter and not cause a shortage of its goods on the market. Earlier, France's largest aluminum smelter, Aluminium Dunkerque, said it would cut production by about 20% due to rising energy prices. Another glass manufacturer, Arc, also said it would lower output and move a number of employees to part-time work. Meanwhile, Bloomberg wrote, the European Union is trying to determine whether it's feasible to use the assets of the Russian Central Bank that have been frozen by member states to finance Ukraine, Bloomberg reported recently. The discussions are at an early stage and legal experts have been asked to look into possible options, the outlet wrote, citing people familiar with the matter. Some $300 billion belonging to the Russian Central Bank were frozen by the EU, the US and their allies as part of anti-Russia sanctions. Any EU action would deal with assets held in Europe, Bloomberg says, adding that the last month, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said that the EU wanted to confiscate Russian assets in order to use them for the reconstruction of Ukraine, but admitted that establishing a legal base for such a move was tricky. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said in May that seizing the assets was not something legally permissible in the United States. Russia strongly criticized the freezing of funds, with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov accusing the West of essentially committing theft.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Western hype over Iran providing Russia with drones was recently explained with any ambiguous details, which was clarified by the Iranian foreign minister. He said that Iran has provided Russia with a limited number of drones months before the war in Ukraine. Nevertheless, the Ukrainian president has argued against that and is pushing for sanctions against Iran, even threatening Iran militarily. Ironically, it has been the U.S. and its NATO member allies that have been fueling the war by providing Ukraine with weapons and with military assistance. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Gilbert Doctorow is an independent international affairs analyst joining us from Brussels. Also joining us is Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, who joins us from London.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Gilbert Doctorow, let me first start with you. Taking a look at what Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has said about this, and I'm going to quote him, Iran has provided Russia with a limited number of drones months before the war in Ukraine. Of course, he has said other things too, which we'll get into. What is your initial reaction on this particular revelation by the Iranian Foreign Minister?
Well, it's very, very good that a statement like this has been made. At the same time, the overall position of Iran and of Russia as well is to deny that Iran is providing assistance to the Russian war effort in Ukraine. I don't call anybody a liar. Little polite lies are the currency, the common currency of diplomacy on all sides. It has been that way in the past, it's that way in the present, and will be in the future. So it is not necessary to stop at this statement that was made today. I think it's reasonable to say that Iran has facilitated Russian use of drones in one way or another, whether by supplying complete drones or providing the license for production of those drones in Russia. There is little doubt in my mind that Iran is facilitating the Russian effort, and that this contribution by Iran is enormously important in putting a quick end to this war. The drones have been used by the Russians primarily in their destruction of infrastructure of the electricity generation and distribution. The Ukrainians now report that 40% of their national generation of electricity has been destroyed. The drones are unique in their ability to get through the Ukrainian air defenses, which in some cities like Kiev have been very well developed. The drones are by nature rather inexpensive, and if you use missiles in your anti-attack systems, you are spending a great deal of money to chase a very low-cost attacker. Moreover, the systems that are in place to down Russian cruise missiles are simply not adapted or suitable for downing drones. So the drones have gotten in, they've done their work, and the destruction of the energy generation and distribution in Ukraine is at the present moment a very important avenue for ending the war quickly. Today, Mr. Zelensky was reported as saying that that in case electricity is cut off completely in Ukraine, in Kiev, that is, and this is entirely possible in the coming days and weeks, then 3 million people will have to be evacuated. This is quite extraordinary, the statement. It is totally irresponsible and unrealizable, but nonetheless, it indicates the desperation of the Kievan regime. A total blackout, which is foreseeable, according to the latest statements by those responsible for managing the national electricity grid in Ukraine, a total blackout is possible, and that would by itself greatly hamper, if not destroy entirely, the Ukrainian military force. It would disintegrate. A blackout would be decisive.
Okay, again, just to clarify here, Marcus Papadopoulos, our guest there, talked about the use of these drones in the war. The official line from Iran is, and I'm going to quote our foreign minister, "I would like to emphasize that the fuss made by some Western countries that Iran has provided Russia with missiles and drones, claims about the missile part is completely wrong, and the drone part is correct," again, provided the months before the war in Ukraine. And there was supposed to be a meeting, according to our foreign minister, to explain this to the Ukrainian side, but based on what he has said, the Ukraine officials didn't show up because of European and Western pressure, because they said you can't sit around and have coffee with Iranian officials. What is your reaction to this?
Given that Iran has a strategic partnership with Russia, it is conceivable, and I emphasize the word conceivable, that Iran has either sent drones to Russia or shared drone technology with Russia during the Russian military's campaign in Ukraine. That all said, however, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has issued a statement refuting Western allegations that it has sent drones to Russia since the start of the Russian military campaign in Ukraine. Now, why should we dismiss the statement from the Iranian Foreign Ministry? Why? Because it is from the Iranian Foreign Ministry? Conversely, why should we treat as gospel each and every word that is spoken by Zelensky or another Ukrainian government official? Furthermore, why should we treat as gospel each and every word spoken by either a British or an American government official? That is a very important question which we have to highlight. And of course, the answer is quite simply this. Iran is a member of the United Nations. Iran is an independent sovereign country. Iran has dignity. The Iranians have issued a rebuttal. Therefore, the ball, so to speak, is now in the court of the West to supply concrete evidence that Iran has supplied the Russian army with drones since the 24th of February. However, if, let's say, theoretically, Iran has supplied the Russian army with drones since the start of Russia's campaign in Ukraine.
Okay.
Well, that would be no different to how America and Britain replenished the stocks of the Israeli military during Israel's numerous invasions of Lebanon. Also, it would be no different to how Britain and America replenishes the stocks of the Saudi Arabian military during Saudi Arabia's ongoing campaign in Yemen, which has caused the deaths of 400,000 Yemeni men, women, and children.
Sure, point taken. Gilbert Doctorow, so you're of the belief that these drones were actually used and they were very effective, even though, again, I have to make sure that I say this because I have to, and the Iranian line is not that. But is there a possibility that, given the stage that this war is at and given the reaction that we have seen from the Ukrainian President Zelensky, which I'm sure is being also instructed to spew whatever lines it is from the U.S. and its NATO partner allies, that because they're not doing that well in this war, that they're using this as a scapegoat and perhaps at the same time maybe demonizing Iran in this form and fashion?
Well, I'd like to respond to what you just asked, at the same time to take in the remarks of my fellow panelist with as to who is saying this. I can tell you the Russians are saying this, not the official Russian government. But about 6 weeks ago, I heard on Russia's leading political talk show, the Vladimir Solovyov Evening Show, one of the panelists mentioned that, you know, we could really use military equipment from Iran, and we could really use military equipment from North Korea. And the first to be highlighted in the New York Times and the Financial Times has been the alleged delivery of drones to Russia from Iran. So I go back to the Russians saying this would be very nice if it happened. As for North Korea, we haven't heard anything about it until just about now. Russian media are explaining how North Korea has munitions which are very suitable for Russian use in artillery, because most of what North Korea produces is copies of equipment from the Soviet Union and China. We have heard allegations in the last 2 or 3 days that North Korea is supplying artillery munitions to Russia. Surprise, surprise. We have heard yesterday on Russian media that Russia is about to place orders for clothing, the military uniforms and so forth, from North Korea. So what was let out unofficially on Russian state television 6 weeks to 8 weeks ago about the intentions of receiving, of procuring relevant equipment from Iran and from North Korea is, I'd say, being realized. It's not an allegation that's coming out of thin air.
Mm. Well, at the same time, Marcus Papadopoulos, what does that say when they are, again, if it's all alleged here, but if it were to be true, how all these months, I think it's 9 months or more now, that the U.S. and its NATO partners have been pumping military aid and weapons and equipment of all kinds, and yet you're having them be at the state that they are in now in terms of whatever power, if you want to say, has been decreased from their military might, even after all this time. What does that say about the state of affairs militarily for Ukraine?
I have said ever since the Russian army commenced its military campaign in Ukraine that Russia is winning the war and that Russia will emerge victorious. I have also said that the state of that Ukraine will cease to exist, or a rump steak of Ukraine will be left. And that rump steak will comprise the westernmost part of the country, Lvov, Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, Volyn, and Rivne. The Russian industrial military complex is absolutely enormous. Russia has armaments factories which are the size of small towns. I suggest people research the Russian city of Magnitorsk, which is adjacent to the Russian-Kazakh border. There, in that one city alone, which is virtually an armaments city, that city can replenish any losses that the Russian military incur in terms of weaponry in a very short period of time. So if Russia is buying military equipment from either Iran or North Korea, then this military equipment will amount to a very small percentage of the overall equipment which the Russian military is deploying in Ukraine. The Russians in storage have thousands and thousands of tanks. Russia can call up, if need be, 25 million soldiers. Russia is a military superpower. Russia, therefore, does not need Iran, does not need North Korea to win this war. And as you have said on a number of occasions so far during this discussion, the audacity of the Americans and the British and the European Union to criticize Iran for allegedly supplying weapons to Russia in this conflict is quite remarkable, given the amount of weaponry that the West has poured into Ukraine, so much so that the Canadian military and the German military have depleted their own stockpiles.
Sure. All right. So, Gilbert, Doctorow, just a very simple question over here. I think the U.S. pledged another close to $500 million in military assistance. What if that stopped? What if U.S. and the NATO countries just didn't provide any weapons, and they said, "Okay, let's talk." Why is that not happening?
It's not happening because of the United States. The United States dictates to its NATO allies what the official line will be, and they act accordingly. The United States is hoping, it has been since February, to use the Ukraine conflict to wear down Russian military strength and to deplete its officer caste and its capability of waging major war on the ground. That has been the hope, and it has not yet been abandoned. The Biden administration has made this part of its official policy. It stands by that. And pending a reversal in the midterm elections this week, it will continue to be obstinate and to resist negotiations. As for the situation within Ukraine, I agree substantially with the remarks made by my fellow panelist, except for the very beginning of this special military operation. It got off to a bad start. It got off to a bad start because there clearly were serious errors in the military intelligence which was being fed to the Kremlin. The expectation was that Kiev would fold, that the population would come out with flowers to meet the Russian tanks. That was way off base, and it failed to take into account the remaking of the Ukrainian military force and the remaking of Ukraine's national identity in the last 8 years under the close supervision of the United States and its NATO allies. However, after this initial setback, which unfortunately gave a bad signal to Western military observers that Russia was weak and incapable, after that initial setback, Russia refound its balance, repositioned itself, first for a war of attrition, and then after the various terrorist attacks of several weeks ago, it took off the gloves and it moved from what is essentially a limited military operation to open warfare. The destruction, with the help of drones, whoever's drones they may be, the destruction of the electric grid has great importance for destroying the fighting morale of the Ukrainian nation, but more importantly, for interrupting the logistics of supply. Because in answer to one of your questions earlier, without the steady stream of armaments coming from the West through Poland and into Lvov, and then by rail across Ukraine to the several front lines in the east and south of the country. Without that steady flow, the Ukrainian military is finished, kaput. It doesn't have reserves of arms to maintain its positions.
Sure. Well, the gains that the U.S. is making here is rather quickly coming into light, Marcus Papadopoulos. We've all said, and I think you agree, that obviously the U.S. arms manufacturers are reaping fantastic profits on this. That much is well known. But now we're looking at the U.S.'s economic interests. And in particular, we're looking how that is coming at the cost of the European Union. Reports now coming at how there's a deindustrialization happening. We are having factories being relocated to the U.S. Not relocated. They're opting to open up their factories in the U.S. because of the high energy prices combined with the incentives from this Inflation Reduction Act that the U.S. passed. So much so that you had Germany and France, who were at odds on certain issues, to unite and telling the U.S., you better do something about this. And then, of course, we have the visit of the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to China with an economic delegation to shake hands on solidifying their trade interests and enhancing that. Are we looking at now the EU waking up to what's going on?
I can only hope, but I doubt, however, that the European Union will be able to free itself of its American shackles. The Americans have seized an opportunity to eradicate the European Union's trade relationship with Russia. And instead, the Americans are now making the European Union beholden on trade and energy supplies with America, which demonstrates how America treats its own friends and allies. One would expect the Americans to attempt to destroy the Russian economy. After all, Russia is an adversary to America. But look at how the Americans treat the European Union. The European Union is a strategic ally to America.
Sure.
And most EU members are members of NATO. And still, the Americans
okay.
are prepared
okay.
to see European industries destroyed.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We just don't have the time. Okay. And I thank you
Good.
For that. Gilbert
okay.
Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Historian, political analyst.